Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the enormous financial clout Saudi Arabia wields in Washington through lobbying firms who then pass on the money to politicians, retired senior government officials, and think tanks. Dr. Ben Freeman, the director and founder of the Foreign Influence Transparency Initiative at the Center for International Policy, who is the author of The Foreign Policy Auction, joins us to discuss how presumably now the Saudi lobbyists are working overtime, along with President Trump, to defend the indefensible as the whole world, with the exception of the White House and Fox News, is appalled at the brazen butchery of Jamal Khashoggi, apparently ordered by the Saudi Crown Prince. With some Washington lobbying firms dropping their lucrative Saudi client, we'll examine how, after shelling out millions and having exerted enormous influence in Washington for decades, Saudi spending in 2017 was nearly three times what it was a year earlier. And we'll assess whether the vocal outrage at Saudi behavior coming from prominent Republican senators will have an effect on Trump's efforts at a cover-up, since the Congress can exert its authority on arms sales and possibly impose sanctions on the kingdom to pressure the king to ditch his son, the Crown Prince, who Senator Graham describes as a wrecking ball. Then we'll speak with Max Hoffman, the Associate Director for National Security and International Policy at the Center for American Progress, whose research focuses on Turkey and the Kurdish regions. He joins us to discuss if and when the Turks will release the audio and video evidence they have been leaking, which they claim are recordings of the actual torture, murder, and dismemberment of the Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi. We will assess what leverage President Erdogan might be using over the Saudis and what would prompt him to either release the evidence or bury it in a secret deal with Trump and the Saudis. Then finally, we'll speak with John Judas, editor-at-large of Talking Points Memo, whose latest book just out is The Nationalist Revival, Trade, Emigration, and the Revolt Against Globalization. He joins us to discuss his article at The New York Times, What the Left Misses About Nationalism, and argue that as long as corporations are free to roam the globe in search of lower wages and taxes, and as long as the United States opens its borders to millions of unskilled immigrants, liberals will not be able to create an equitable society free from the anxieties of obtaining health care, education, and housing. And joining us now is Dr. Ben Freeman, the director and founder of the Foreign Influence Transparency Initiative at the Center for International Policy, where he works to expose how foreign governments are influencing U.S. public policy and elections. Previously, the National Security Fellow at the Project on Government Oversight, where he spearheaded the Foreign Influence Database, he's the author of The Foreign Policy Auction. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Ben Freeman.
Thank you very much for having me.
And it's no secret that the Saudi Arabians have been spreading money around Capitol Hill for a long, long time. And when senior officials retire from the State Department, the CIA, the Pentagon, they often get sort of sinecures with Saudi banks or even non-existent companies. But now I assume, now that you have the Secretary of State and the President of the United States full on working to essentially craft the Saudi response, which they've for the life of me, they still can't come up with an excuse. They keep saying that they're going to blame a rogue element, but we still haven't had an official statement out of them. But meanwhile, you have the President of the United States and the Secretary of State of the United States carrying their water and defending them on the world stage when the entire world and all the world leaders can see exactly what's happened and are completely appalled. So does that mean the Saudis are going to spend even more money in Washington?
Yeah, I think there is a good chance that the Saudis could take this as an opportunity to double down on their influence operations in D.C. And they may have to, because what we've already seen so far is that several of the lobbying and public relations firms that they had working for them, they've already quit. And these are some of the bigger firms, too, like the Glover Park Group, for example. It's a Democratic-leaning organization. They were one of the, you know, the power players for the Saudis, and they've already quit. But I expect from the Saudis' point of view, they'll just replace them. They'll hire another firm. So if there's one thing I can tell you in this town, there's always another lobbyist willing to take a paycheck.
So the ones that are stuck with them, though, are still Hogan, Lovells, and Brownstein, Hyatt, Farber, Schreck. Now, not that anybody knows them, but I take it, Ben Freeman, you know who these people are.
Yeah, for sure. These are, the two you mentioned are two of the biggest remaining lobbying shops working for the Saudis. Another one that's remained steadfast with the Saudis almost since 9/11 is a firm that was formerly called Corvus Communications. Now it's referred to as the MSL Group. And they're really the kings of PR, public relations for the Saudis. And they're one of the largest public relations firms in the world, in fact. They're still, seemingly a proud Saudi client, and it doesn't look like there's any sign of that changing in the future either.
So how do they work? These big lobbying firms on K Street essentially get money from Saudi Arabia, and then they pass it through to politicians and their re-election campaigns. Is that how it works?
Yeah, I mean, that's it really is that simple, and that's the craziest part about this. The way U.S. laws work is that There's a law barring foreign nationals from making campaign contributions in U.S. elections, but there's no law barring a foreign government or any foreign national from hiring a lobbyist in D.C. to work on their behalf and paying them pretty lavishly to do that. And then there's no law barring that lobbyist from making a campaign contribution to anyone they wish, as long as it's within the limits of our election law. And so what these lobbyists can then do is take very very hefty salaries and sign very hefty contracts with the Saudis, meet with members of Congress on behalf of the Saudis, and then that very same day even, they can make a campaign contribution to that member of Congress. And what I found in my research is at least 11 times in just 2017, where lobbyists working for the Saudis did exactly that.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Ben Freeman, who's director and founder of the Foreign Influence Transparency Initiative at the Center for International Policy, where he works to expose how foreign governments are influencing U.S. public policy and elections. And previously, he was the National Security Fellow at the Project on Government Oversight, where he spearheaded the Foreign Influence Database, and he's the author of The Foreign Policy Auction. But they also, the Saudis, fund Washington think tanks, the Center for Strategic International Studies, for example, the Emerson Collective. Again, how, I mean, they've got to be working overtime now to put lipstick on this pig, right?
I think for think tanks that do receive Saudi funding, that they're in a very, very awkward position. It's sort of, an unspoken secret in D.C. that a lot of think tanks do take a lot of money from foreign governments. But most of the time, that sort of goes unmentioned. But now, with everything that's happening with Saudi Arabia and the public outcry, all of that Saudi money pouring into a lot of think tanks is being incredibly scrutinized. And you've already seen some instances of think tanks jumping ship from the Saudis. One of the first to do that was the Brookings Institution, which had a research grant from Saudi Arabia. And they said just a few days ago that they said they were going to return that money and they were going to sever ties with Saudi Arabia over this. And I think what you'll see in the future is that more and more think tanks will start to do that if Saudi Arabia continues this sort of ridiculous farce of a cover-up of the death of Jamal Khashoggi.
Well, we've seen what the Saudis have done to Canada. I mean, over the slightest criticism, obviously MBS is very thin-skinned, if not impetuous and violent, which would seem to be the case with the fact now we know from the New York Times that some of the MBS's closest aides are there in Turkey at the consulate. So it's hard not to assume that the butchering of this dissident was done on the direct orders of MBS. But prior to this, he got very upset with the Canadians over something that was very slight, and he really did go to town on them. So do you think the threats that came out after Trump on 60 Minutes said that he would deal with it severely if it was proven that the Saudis had something to do with this or were responsible? Immediately, the Saudis put out a statement saying that they could retaliate even stronger than what Trump threatened. Not that anybody's taking Trump's threat seriously, because you could just see from the body language of the Secretary of State laughing and joking with MBS that they're not there to censure these guys. They're there to orchestrate a cover-up on their behalf.
Yeah, the whole trip there, from the way Secretary Pompeo and Donald Trump are behaving, it's almost as if they're serving as the personal public relations associates for the Saudi kingdom. And what we're seeing from them, it's just so out of character with what everyone in the world and even everyone in the Republican Party is saying about this incident. I think it's very important to remember that this isn't a partisan issue at all. In fact, Congress is probably more united on this issue than they've been on any issue in quite some time. Some of the most outspoken critics of the Saudis on this have been Republicans, like Lindsey Graham, like Marco Rubio. These are people who have gone on national television and blasted the Saudis for this. And yet you still have Trump basically towing the Saudi line on this. It really doesn't make a lot of sense why he's doing this.
So what is the leverage that the Saudis have? I mean, in my understanding from talking to experts on Saudi Arabia, that MBS is so ruthless that he's basically extinguished all opposition. He's coalesced the three separate militaries, controls all three, and the intelligence services. And even if there's pressure from Washington on his father, the king, to ditch the kid, the boy king, and put in somebody else, then that's just not going to happen. So if you've got this vengeful fellow still in power, what do you think he's going to do to retaliate? Because Trump, as much as he's carrying water for MBS, it's the House and Senate that can basically cancel these arms deals. Not that they're, this $110 billion is a fiction, but nevertheless, whatever they are, there's some leverage on our side. So what leverage do the Saudis have, apart from the obvious that they've got an enormous amount of oil?
Yeah, the Saudis have an enormous amount of oil, but actually their oil output is really comparable to our U.S. oil output. And so we don't have this overwhelming reliance on Saudi oil. So that's very misleading. And we also, you know, beyond that, we don't have an incredible amount of entrenched economic ties with them. You know, overall U.S. trade isn't very high with Saudi Arabia. Sure, they're the number one buyer of U.S. arms, but we have plenty of other countries who also buy U.S. arms, and we also spend more on our own military than any other country in the world by far. So defense contractors aren't going to go hungry anytime soon here. That leverage is completely overblown. That said, on the other side, I think Saudi Arabia can make some credible threats to do some very bad things. And folks often forget that 15 of the 19 hijackers on 9/11 were from Saudi Arabia. And so that's definitely a concern with us, and being able to work with Saudi Arabia to cut down on violent extremism. You know, they could certainly stop some of those efforts, which could be very bad for the U.S. But we can't let them hold us hostage. At the end of the day, Saudi Arabia needs the U.S. far more than the U.S. needs Saudi Arabia. And our president should remember that.
But, for example, if the Saudis stopped flooding the market to make up for the squeeze that the U.S. is putting on Iranian oil, the price of oil would go up very quickly, and it would be reflected at the pump just before an election. And that could hurt the Republicans, surely.
It could. It could, for sure. But oil issues like that tend to take a little longer. So I don't quite know if we're in that bubble window before the election for that to hurt. They certainly could do that. But I think at this point, you know, Donald Trump has really been the greatest ally that this kind of corrupt Saudi regime has. And so for them to do that and hurt him and his party, I think would be very foolish on their part. So I don't really see that as a likely outcome.
So what are you hearing in Washington? You mentioned that the Senate and the House are all, they understand what really happened, particularly Lindsey Graham, who was pretty outspoken, saying, you know, this guy's got to go, referring to MBS. He said he's a wrecking ball. He's got to go. Is that what's going on there? I mean, do you think that Trump's going to pull this off? The world is being taken over by gangsters. And as far as I see it, all of these people involved in this situation are criminal kleptocrats akin to Putin. The Trump family, you know, it's not about government to government. This is family to family with the Saudis. That's probably why they get on so well with our young prince, Jared, being best friends with their young crown prince. Then you've got Erdogan, who's a criminal and a kleptocrat. And then you've got the Saudis. And this kid bought a $500 million Leonardo da Vinci that may be a fake. $300 million for a chateau in France and another $500 million for a yacht. So that's all on a government salary. So this is the way I see it. I would think that if justice prevailed in this unfortunately corrupt world we live in, that both Trump and MBS would go down, and most of all, Jared. But how do you see it?
Well, I think what we're seeing here in D.C. is that you have an almost unanimous choir saying that the Saudis did this and that they should be punished. And in mind you, this isn't just conjecture. A lot of these folks, a lot of these congressional Republicans who are calling out the Saudis, they've been briefed by intelligence agencies on this. You know, they've seen the intelligence that the U.S. has about this incident, and they've made it very clear. Bob Corker on national television said, it looks like the Saudis did this. So it's not conjecture, and everybody here is really on the same page, except for the Trump administration. And so what I see happening is that Congress, they have a lot of options, a lot of different ways they can punish the Saudis, whether it's through sanctions, as you mentioned, cutting off arms sales, or it's cutting off U.S. military support for the Saudis in Yemen. They have a lot of different things that they can do to punish the Saudis, and I think they're going to do it. I think everybody here is unified, and they're going to pass some of these laws. And even if Trump were to veto them, they have the votes to override that veto. And at the end of the day, I think Congress is going to do the right thing on this.
So what do you think about, though, since MBS made this big splash about being tech savvy, and that was in part helped by Tom Friedman of the New York Times, but he did visit Silicon Valley, and I believe that Saudi investment money is fairly significant in venture capital in Silicon Valley. And those big Silicon Valley companies, of course, are the biggest companies in the world now. Is that a factor, do you think? If these lobbyists in Washington are pulling the plug on the Saudis, do you think Silicon Valley will?
Yeah, I do. And I think the business community has sent a pretty strong signal to the Saudis, too, by pulling out of this so-called Davos in the Desert conference that the Saudis were scheduled to host in a couple weeks. You have businesses, you know, from across the spectrum that have already pulled out of that conference, media outlets too, and a CNN pulled out of it, and all kinds of different businesses have pulled out of that. And I think they're sending a clear signal that this behavior is not okay. And let's be honest about Silicon Valley. If Silicon Valley wants to raise money, they can go to a lot of different places to get that money. They are not reliant on the Saudis or Saudi oil to raise revenue. And I think if they know that there is a price to pay for getting money from the Saudis, I think they'll stop doing it.
Well, Dr. Ben Freeman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me. Have a great day.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Ben Freeman, who's the director and founder of the Foreign Influence Transparency Initiative at the Center for International Policy, where he works to expose how foreign governments are influencing U.S. public policy and elections. And previously, he was a National Security Fellow at the Project on Government Oversight, where he spearheaded the Foreign Influence Database, and is the author of The Foreign Policy Auction. We're going to take a brief station break and back discussing if and when the Turks will release the audio and video evidence they claim to have of the actual torture, murder, and dismemberment of the Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi.
Come, you masters of war. You that build the big guns. You that build the death planes. You that build all the bombs. You that hide behind walls. that hide behind desks. I just don't want you.
اكتب وخط بالقلم بالقلم اكتب وخط بالقلم دموع من عيني دموع من عيني يا ناس مالي حدا يا ناس مالي حدا بهمي واسيني.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Max Hoffman, who's the Associate Director for National Security and International Policy at the Center for American Progress, where his research focuses on Turkey and the Kurdish regions. Welcome to Background Briefing, Max Hoffman.
Thanks, Ian. Good to be with you.
And what can we make of the fact that the Turkish leadership via the press, which they control, and clearly a lot of this is coming from their intelligence service, the MIT, continually leaks more and more grisly and incriminating details about the murder and dismemberment of Jamal Khashoggi, the Washington Post reporter in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. And yet, President of the United States and his Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, are almost trying to orchestrate the Saudi cover-up, and the Saudis still haven't come out with an official statement, even though it almost is like Trump is coaching them. They're sort of dithering about how to come up with an official statement. And then at the airport, as he was leaving Saudi Arabia at the King Salman Air Base in Riyadh, U.S. Secretary of State on his way to Turkey to meet with Erdogan says, "I don't want to talk about any of the facts." Was there ever a truer statement made by the Trump administration?
That's right. I mean, it's been very interesting to watch, because I think everyone anticipated when this story first emerged that, you know, all sides would kind of seek a face-saving way out of it, because, you know, of course, these are two big regional powers in Turkey and Saudi Arabia. They have, you know, fairly substantial interests at stake that they can influence, you know, on both sides. And then the U.S., of course, these are two of the U.S.'s longest-standing security partners in the region, and U.S. interests, you know, certainly wouldn't be served by them, you know, being at loggerheads. So I think everyone anticipated there would be some sort of face-saving route out. I don't think anyone anticipated that the President of the United States would sort of be turned into the PR agent here for Saudi Arabia, and as you say, kind of feeding them the excuses they need to make to get out of this horrific incident and what they've done here. You know, the other piece of it is that Turkey very clearly seems to kind of want to elevate the issue and really make an issue of this. We've got to be a bit careful, because we're relying on, you know, we don't have all the facts. We're relying on intelligence leaks from all sides, as you say. So it's all somewhat tentative, but there's a lot of evidence that the Saudis really planned this execution, this murder, and on Turkish soil. The Turks are understandably angry about that. It's horrific, and it's a clear violation of their sovereignty. In addition, Khashoggi or Khashoggi, depending on if you use the sort of which pronunciation, he had ties to President Erdogan's inner circle. Several of Erdogan's advisors immediately brought this to him. Khashoggi's wife, you know, her first call when he failed to materialize outside the consulate was to Erdogan's inner circle. So that matters in an authoritarian one-man state like Turkey. I'd also note that it's fairly ironic to see Turkey kind of this staunch rhetorical defense of press freedom and, standing up against authoritarian overreach when, of course, they themselves are the leading jailer of journalists in the world and, a sort of sliding into authoritarianism themselves. But this, this kind of open confrontation, I think, has a lot of lessons about the state of the Middle East and these newly assertive regional powers.
But what's going on, though, in terms of the negotiations that Turkey's had with Saudi Arabia? It seems like they didn't work out very well. It seems like that subsequent to the talks that took place, Erdogan has upped the ante and leaked even more stuff.
It does. I mean, I don't think anybody outside of maybe the sort of intelligence community is privy to the details of those conversations. So we'll really have to wait to know what the Turks and the Saudis discussed. But what's clear is that there was a, in the immediate wake of the incident, I don't think this incident was ever going to be sort of swept under the rug because Khashoggi was a Washington Post contributor. It was almost inevitably going to be, you know, front page news of the Washington Post when a contributor disappears in the Saudi consulate, and rightly so. But, you know, the Turks did seem to make a decision to leak the really gruesome details of the murder, which has made it perhaps a bigger story than it might have otherwise been. And that, you know, that is a choice. Now, whether they did that because they felt Saudi Arabia had sort of violated the protection Turkey had offered to Khashoggi, or whether the reasons go deeper than that, or whether they're bargaining with Saudi Arabia for other issues, it's not clear. But they started leaking these details, and then they paused as the two countries were negotiating, as Erdogan and Mohammed bin Salman, or actually King Salman, Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince, has sort of been held responsible for this overreach, but Erdogan was talking with the king himself. They, you know, they paused the leaks when they were talking and then resumed them. So clearly the Turks did not hear what they wanted to hear. And this whole idea, this explanation that these are rogue killers, as Trump sort of fed to the Saudis almost, it's clear that's not going to fly with the Turks. What, you know, the bigger issues at stake here are, if you back up 3 years or so to 2015, it looked as if Turkey and Saudi Arabia were in alignment. Saudi was trying to pull Turkey into a Sunni bloc to confront Iran in the region. They were cooperating very closely to overthrow Assad in Syria. And, you know, it seemed as if these two regional powers would, you know, become more deeply entwined. But the disagreements between them have just been too deep to bridge. Saudi Arabia really folded their hand in Syria, leaving Turkey to hold the bag, which angered Ankara. Saudi, you know, and Turkey have deep disagreements on the role of political Islam in the region. The Saudis think that the Turks back the Muslim Brotherhood, and there's some truth to that, whereas the Turks feel that the Saudis are part of this sort of authoritarian, anti-Islamic counter-revolution almost across the region. And then they're also at loggerheads over the issue of Qatar and this deep Gulf crisis, you know, the crisis between the Gulf countries, again, over the role of political Islam. So now these issues are really bursting into the open, and we're in the midst of this intelligence and information war between two of the most powerful countries in the Middle East.
And again, I'm speaking with Max Hoffman, who's Associate Director for National Security and International Policy at the Center for American Progress, where his research focuses on Turkey and the Kurdish region. So at what point, though, does Erdogan give permission to the MIT to release all this stuff to the press, the stuff that they've been leaking, the actual pictures, audio, whatever they claim to have, both audio and video? I don't know whether they're bluffing, but at some point or other, doesn't the international community, particularly the international press, at some point call their bluff and, you know, let's see this stuff. Because as Trump and Pompeo try to suggest, Trump even went so far as to say that we're treating MBS like the Kavanaugh was treated. Then the best way to refute that is to show the evidence. So do you think we'll see this? Because some people, I talked to Henri Barker yesterday, and he said that maybe Erdogan's bluffing. He doesn't have this evidence. What do you think?
I mean, really anything is possible. As you say, Erdogan and the AKP completely control the Turkish media. They can feed whatever stories they want. But, you know, it would be a fairly brazen bluff, I think, on Erdogan's part to sort of get, you know, go out there with these kind of grisly details without some evidence behind it. But he's brazenly bluffed in the past, so I wouldn't sort of be sure one way or the other. What I would say, though, is this really gets back to the role of the U.S. and the role of President Trump in all of this. You know, these regional powers, Turkey and Saudi Arabia, are really throwing their weight around because they feel as if they're, you know, there's no adult at home, that, you know, the U.S. the U.S.'s traditional leadership role, its traditional role mediating these kinds of disputes, has been effectively abandoned. And these countries, powerful countries, are pursuing their regional interests with little regard for sort of international law or any sort of standard beyond what, you know, might makes right. And that's I think, what fed the Saudis' idea that they could get away with something like this. Turkey is you know, leaking all these details, and the general public and the international community doesn't know which side to believe, in part because, you know, again, the office of the President of the United States and the U.S. government has been relatively silent and is not sort of going out there with their version of the facts. We've heard all sorts of different stories, and we're relying on intelligence leaks. So, you know, this is a pretty dangerous period where all sense of international norms or rule of law, or, you know, the U.S. as a regional or a global kind of, you know, moderating force have just gone out the window. And we're really in this kind of dog-eat-dog jungle law. And that's a scary place, I think, for all of us.
But when you say there's no adult at home, meaning the White House is absent, AWOL, it's true that Trump doesn't seem to have much interest in foreign policy and doesn't listen to anybody anymore. He's feeling very confident. But he's mostly about transactions, and the line between representing the United States and representing the Trump organization is very blurred. And in many ways, you can see the affinity that MBS has towards Trump and Jared, Prince Jared, because it's family to family. You know, that's how they operate. And Erdogan also has a family racket going there as well. So, you know, it's possible you've got these three kind of kleptocrats all scratching each other's back. And at some point or other, the Saudis, do you think the Saudis could bribe Erdogan into silence?
You know, I certainly wouldn't rule it out. I think that, you know, there are huge financial stakes for the various countries and economies at play. But then, as you say, for the leaders themselves, there are also serious financial stakes. I mentioned earlier Turkey's close relations with Qatar. That those have grown up over a number of years to the point where Turkish troops were stationed in Qatar, which may have even prevented a Saudi Emirati, you know, direct intervention when the Saudis and Qatar were at loggerheads. But part of that relationship between Turkey and Qatar is also direct aid. You know, Qatar bought Erdogan a new presidential plane for more than $500 million. So these are sort of direct. Whenever Erdogan needs spending money, he's gone to the Gulf. He's traditionally gone to Qatar, not the Saudis. But of course, Saudi Arabia could offer some incentives to sort of drop this issue quietly. And Erdogan has complete control of not just the Turkish government, but the press and the society and the economy at large. He can sort of order companies to do as he pleases. So certainly they could try and grease the wheels. But Erdogan clearly is driving a hard bargain by leaking all of these details and sort of digging in on the Khashoggi issue. I also wouldn't discount, you know, that just because Erdogan is an authoritarian figure who has abused the rule of law, he doesn't view himself that way, right? He still views himself as a defender of Turkish sovereignty, you know, standing up to all sorts of international powers. And the fact that the Saudis felt as if they could send 15 guys into Turkey and murder someone who had been under Turkish protection, effectively, right under the MIT's noses, that must grate, and that must be something of a humiliation for Erdogan and the Turks. So there's probably that element of not just sort of personal pride, but national pride at play here as well.
Well, just in closing, Max Hoffman, what would your bet be on whether the truth will prevail? Because, you know, the world is drifting. Democracies are very frail, and Turkey being an example of how a democracy can be sort of hijacked into a kleptocracy and a sort of soft authoritarian state. Soft, I guess, if you're in prison in Turkey, and if you're a journalist, it's not particularly soft. But, you know, you've got Putin running a gangster state, MBS being a total kleptocrat, and the Trump administration or the Trump family showing that they have no moral qualms, they don't care about human rights, they only care about money. This is a pretty sad picture. So to my mind, this is a very important moment that we have here. If the Turks do reveal this information that they've been leaking and it turns out to be true, then I think that will be a very important moment to pull over some of these crooks and hold them to account. And that's what I'm hoping for. Do you think it's going to happen?
You know, I'm hesitant. I don't think we have enough information to make any sort of good predictions, but I would be very skeptical, unfortunately, that we'll ever get the full unvarnished truth. I mean, there are clearly ongoing efforts, not just by the Saudis, but by, you know, potentially the President of the United States to sort of cover things up. And we're relying again on intelligence agencies and on Turkish news outlets and a Turkish government that is really not trustworthy on its own. And the U.S. government's role of sort of traditional arbiter and putting out, you know, a quote-unquote official or at least a plausible version of events that rooted in facts, that's been abdicated under this administration. So I don't know if we'll ever learn the full truth, but I'm sure that you know, there will have to be some sort of these parties will have to settle on some version of events to put out there. Otherwise, the sort of political costs for Erdogan and also for the Saudis in terms of the reputational damage, the potential risks to their arms purchases from the United States and other interests before the Congress. You know, I think they have to kind of come to some sort of settled version of events. But that may bear very little resemblance to the truth. And unfortunately, you know, when this administration is gone, there will have to be a long-term concerted effort to kind of reconstitute just basic norms of international law and behavior and even the sort of the idea that truth can and must be established on the international stage at some basic level. These are really fundamental challenges that we're going to face moving forward.
Well, Max Hoffman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me, and good to talk to you.
Likewise, and again, I've been speaking with Max Hoffman, who's the Associate Director for National Security and International Policy at the Center for American Progress, where his research focuses on Turkey and the Kurdish regions. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into what the left misses about nationalism. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is John Judas, Editor-at-Large of Talking Points Memo, previously Senior Editor of the New Republic and Senior Writer for the National Journal, an active member of SDS and the Left in the 60s. He taught philosophy at Berkeley and at the San Francisco Art Institute, and is the author of The Populist Explosion, How the Great Recession Transformed American and European Politics, one of the first books to explain Donald Trump's candidacy, as well as seven other acclaimed books about politics and international relations. His latest book just out is The Nationalist Revival, Trade, Immigration, and the Revolt Against Globalization. And he has an article at the New York Times, What the Left Misses About Nationalism. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Judas.
Well, glad to be with you.
Well, thank you, John. And I think, you know, your book and your article are very necessary contributions. I'm not entirely convinced that there's going to be a blue wave and that the Democrats are going to sweep Trump out of power or at least constrain him. And I think in part because they haven't learned the lessons from the last election.
Well, I think that it's likely that they are going to win the House, so they will, to some extent, constrain him. But I think this election is going to be fought over the very similar issues to the 2016 issue, which is to say Donald Trump and how either wonderful or terrible he is. And in that sense, it really isn't going to advance the Democrats' political agenda in such a way that in 4 years, 6 years, 8 years, they can become a recapture their majority.
Well, I think the point, though, surely, is that the fact that Trump could capture this angst amongst the white working class about outsourcing, globalization, the rise of China, and China's policies that mean the manufacturing Rust Belt is left behind. These are all issues that would normally be something the Democratic Party would have addressed. And the fact that Trump was able to seize on them and use them so effectively, at the same time do the reverse, which is reward globalist corporations, reward the ultra-rich. Neither Trump nor his mini-me, Jared Kushner, pay taxes. They're violently opposed to social democracy, which is what I think at the end of the day, the point that you're making is that that's what we have to sort of save, if you will. So let's start with
well,
that
it's
premise.
More, you know, it's a little more complicated than that, I think. I think that there was a side of Trump, let's say the Steve Bannon side of Trump, that might have operated differently. I think that, you know, Trump was in one time in favor of single-payer health insurance. And his tax proposals in the campaign were directed at lowering corporate taxes so that the corporations could compete better, but not at the kind of egregious reduction in taxes for the wealthy and so on. I think, again, that's a respect in which Trump, in order to govern, had to ally himself with the business Republicans in Congress. So you really get... You really get a repeat of the worst of business republicanism, plus Trump's various bigoted appeals. So that's the, I mean, that's what I could still have imagined him governing a little differently and doing things that would have benefited his base more than what he's actually done.
Well, but what you're saying, John Judas, is predicated upon the idea that this man has principles, that he has positions, that he has priorities.
Yeah, he had positions. I don't. Let's not get into the question of principles. You know, and that people always say politicians they don't like are unprincipled, but he did have positions. I mean, the America First stuff is very much part of Trump, and the trade issues are very much part of Trump. I mean, he would like to see America running trade surpluses. He'd like to see the factories humming again in the Midwest and in parts of the South. So, there, you know, that's him. Now, the question is whether what he's actually done is going to contribute toward that result.
But again, don't you think that all of the issues that Trump seized on are the ones that the Democrats should have had front and center? That's what I find extraordinary.
Yeah, well, yes, but not exactly the way he seized upon them. I mean, with trade, I'm still not sure, again, what I really don't know what the right strategy is. I would be more in favor of us emulating the Chinese in certain respects, which is to say encouraging industry through subsidizing it and planning and things like that than Trump is willing to do. Obama started to do that in the Energy Department. He started to encourage various kinds of advanced manufacturing. And as far as I know, Trump has pretty much left that in the lurch. So, the Trump addressed a lot of things that are important, but the way he's going about it is not so great.
So let's talk a little bit about how social democracies can be preserved, not that we have anything like the social democracies in Europe. And much of what you've written in your article in the New York Times, What the Left Misses About Nationalism, is about how the political left, particularly in this country, is in denial about why there is so much anxiety amongst working Americans about outsourcing and globalization and being downsized. And so Trump has hardly done anything to preserve what vestiges of social democracy we have. And maybe it's because of the explanation you made earlier that the Republican House and Senators have such hostility towards them, probably at the behest of their paymasters, the Koch brothers. But you can see that even in countries like Sweden that are extremely generous, they're having problems. So give us your take on why you think the Democrats are sort of blind to the anxiety about immigration and globalization.
Well, let me say that they're not entirely blind, but there's different wings of the Democratic Party. And to take two examples, the Goldman Sachs, New York, Wall Street wing, and there's also the, I'm going to have an animal with about four wings here, so you have to be prepared for this. And then there's the Silicon Valley wing, and a lot of money comes from there, and they really are pretty much free traders. They're for open borders to, you know, maybe not open them, but, you know, again, they're not bothered by the idea that several millions of unskilled immigrants come into the country and compete for jobs with the people who are already here because it means it's cheaper services for them. So those are definite forces within the Democratic Party. But, you know, there's Sherrod Brown, Marcy Kaptur from Ohio. I mean, they've understood these issues all along, but they're not, they're again, not in the leadership of the party. Well, we'll have to see what happens in the next 2 years in terms of the presidential election, because that's where the direction of the party gets set. And maybe one of them will sort of pick up where Bernie Sanders left off, or maybe Bernie himself. I mean, I'm unfortunately Bernie's age, and I would prefer somebody much younger to be the nominee. But I, you know, we'll have to see if somebody picks up these issues, because they're there.
Well, it seems so. Whenever Donald Trump talks about jobs, and whenever the Republicans talk about jobs and job creators, I just cringe. It seems to be, and now, of course, Trump is doing it over covering up for what seems to be a monstrous, barbaric crime on the part of the Saudi royal family and the ruler, that behaving no different from the Islamic State in butchering a man.
Well, we have to be nice to him because he's buying our weapon system.
Well, that's what he says, jobs, jobs, jobs. So, you know, I don't know why people fall for that. I really don't. I mean, that is extraordinary how that's become the excuse for modern capitalism. No matter how badly you're treated and how much all of the wealth is being siphoned off by the top 1% of the 1%, we're job creators.
Yes.
But when you say in your New York Times piece, here is the simple truth. As long as corporations are free to roam the globe in search of lower wages and taxes, and as long as the United States opens its borders to millions of unskilled immigrants, liberals will not be able to create bountiful, equitable societies where people are free from basic anxieties about obtaining health care, education, and housing. So that's the case that I'm exploring here. Is that you? Are you saying that basically that globalism is the enemy of social democracy?
Yes, because I mean, to use a simple example, it's very hard to have unions. In other words, it's very hard for the working class to organize when they face a constant threat of corporations moving from the United States to Mexico or overseas and outsourcing what they make here, and when they face competition in a labor market that where there's an oversupply of low-wage workers. So again, it's those two problems are making it very hard for there to be the kind of organized basis that we would need to have social democracy. I think the other thing that's really a problem with globalization is this kind of race to the bottom in terms of taxes, where we keep lowering our taxes on business and the wealthy in order to make them happy. Because what that does, again, is rob us of the kind of economic surplus we need to have, for instance, health care for all, much lower price or free college education, opportunity. So I think in all those respects, we have to really do something new in order to preserve and expand the social democracy that we have.
Well, how does this then relate to the sort of idea of global equity and the third world? In other words, if we are to basically put up barriers, not Trump's wall, but basically stop emigration, start taking care of America first, which is the idea of Steve Bannon and all these people, although I don't buy that they're sincere about it. But nevertheless, you know, Sweden, for example, has a functioning social democracy, but this, because of the rise of this right-wing party, you show that there's some social anxiety there. They're very generous in terms of foreign aid. But is that the formula? In other words, do you put up walls against all the have-nots around the world? You know, you see them drowning in the Mediterranean, for God's sake. This is what's happening on a global scale. I'm just trying to get a sort of kind of a moral picture here of what our global responsibilities are, as opposed to resorting to some form of nationalism.
Well, think of what the alternative is. So we have open borders, free trade. Again, I'm exaggerating a little. And what that encourages are very conservative governments in these countries. Do these conservative governments benefit other less developed countries? I don't think so. They only benefit them by depopulating them, by taking all the, you know, the a lot of the more talented people out of those countries and into United States or Western Europe. So I don't think it's an either-or situation. I think it's a situation where if we're not happy here, if we don't have a kind of social democracy here, we're not even going to be in a position to help countries elsewhere.
So is there, though, a sense that, I mean, you mentioned in your article Donald Trump in front of the United Nations, which is a sort of the global body of multilateralism, talking about, he said in his speech after he made a fool of himself, saying how he's the greatest president in American history and has accomplished more in 2 years than any other prior president. But then he went on to urge the United Nations to reject the ideology of globalism and accept the ideology of patriotism. And that does seem really dangerously anti-historic, if you will. I mean, my God, think about
it. Well, look, the way I put it is that there's a difference between internationalism and globalism or globalization. Globalization really meant subordinating nations themselves and the individuals with them to the imperatives of the private market, multinational corporations. Internationalism, nations coming together in either organizations or temporary coalitions to address problems that they couldn't possibly address by themselves. Climate change, nuclear proliferation, pandemics, local wars, all those kind of things. Now, the problem with Trump is that in the name of rejecting globalization, he also rejects internationalism. And I think that when I talk about nationalism, it's nationalism, again, with a recognition that in very important respects, we have to ally ourselves with other nations to fight these problems that we couldn't do ourselves.
Well, just in closing, what would your advice be to the Democrats running? For example, you've got Beto O'Rourke down there in Texas against Cruz. He's outspending Cruz. But because he has a compassionate and decent position on immigration in that particularly conservative state, that may be the thing that kills him. So what messages should the Democrats have, do you think, in terms of dealing with why so many white working class former Democrats support Republicans now?
I'm not a political consultant. I have an idea of the way I would like the Democrats to go. In terms of this election, they don't have that many choices, and a lot of them really are running against Trump. If they have a big issue, it's health care because of the Republicans trying to defund Obamacare and remove insurance protections for people with pre-existing conditions. So I think that's a good idea. The one thing that I've really warned against is taking, for instance, the kind of issues that Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez used in part of New York City, like abolish ICE or a guaranteed annual income and things like that, and applying it around the country, because then I think they're going to get into big trouble. But I think that Democrats have followed that. I mean, they've tried to pay attention to what their constituents are willing to put up with.
And again, I'm speaking with John Judas, the author of the brand new book just out, The Nationalist Revival, Trade, Immigration, and the Revolt Against Globalization, which we're offering up here in support of Background Briefing and KPFK at 818-985-5735. Your book, of course, I think is vital in understanding why Trump is popular and what he's getting wrong. What he seems to be getting wrong, though, is that he, for example, tearing up Paris Agreement is just catastrophic, obviously. And we may actually run out of time to reverse the calamity that's facing us within decades. That, of course, would be probably one of the greatest sins of history, which he will be judged harshly for if there's any historians left on a flooded planet. The Iran deal, for example, tearing that up has forced all of the other members of the P5 plus one to figure out a way to get around these sanctions, and it may end up, at the end of the day, they may end up finding a way to get around the dollar. And that, to me, is just extraordinary. How, talk about shooting yourself in the foot. If the Americans lose the advantage of having the global reserve currency, that is the greatest self-inflicted wound in history.
Yes, that will be a big problem. It's pretty far in the future, maybe 5, 10 years, 15 years, but Trump is setting the stage for that possibility. I think the more important than getting around the Iran deal is the China and Russia deciding not to use the dollar as their exchange currency. That's a big deal. I mean, you're talking about two very large countries, and of course, particularly China. And, you know, again, we're talking about 5, 10, 15 years, but that would be the point at which the American empire begins to crumble. It's the point at which we will no longer be able to run the big deficits whenever we want, for instance. So that's a big deal, yes.
Well, John Judas, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Sure. Thank you, Ian.
And again, I'm speaking with John Judas, the editor-at-large of Talking Points Memo. He was an active member of SDS and the Left in the 60s and taught philosophy at Berkeley and at the San Francisco Art Institute. He's the author of The Populist Explosion, How the Great Recession Transformed American and European Politics. And his latest book just out is The Nationalist Revival, Trade, Immigration, and the Revolt Against Globalization. And he has an article at the New York Times, What the Left Misses About Nationalism. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.
Standing along the side of the pickup truck.